I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon members. If you'd like to become a Patreon member yourself and help support the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner, or check out the link below. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding. We also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we don't have any guests again, but I did dig into the old magazines that I have. I've got some requests from some of you guys that we talk about some of the older competitions in the bodybuilding history, not just from the 1970s and 80s, but going way back. So that's what we're doing today. We're going to go all the way back to 1947 when Steve Reeves won the Mr. America contest. I've got a couple articles I want to read about that. And then we're going to go to the 1948 Mr. Universe. So this was not officially the first NABBA Mr. Universe, but it was the first Mr. Universe that was held in London, and it was won by the great John Grimmick over Steve Reeves. So we're going to talk about that as well. And then 2 years later was the very first official NABBA Mr. Universe, and that was held in London again. And this time Steve Reeves was the winner. And he beat out Reg Park, who was very young. I think he was only like 21 or something like. And then Reg, of course, won the next year. And then after that, we're going to go over to the Mr. Olympia, and we're going to talk about the 1965 Mr. Olympia, which was the very first Mr. Olympia won by Larry Scott. And then we'll talk about the 1967 Mr. Olympia, which was the second Mr. Olympia winner, which was Sergio Oliva, who won after Larry retired in 1966. So that's what we're going to do today on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Hope you guys are doing good out there. Got a lot of new videos up on YouTube. So if you check out my YouTube channel, I've got a lot of new articles that I've been reading and putting them on YouTube. So these are turning out to be really big hits. I did the 1978 Mr. Olympia report, which came from Muscle Digest magazine. I put that up a couple weeks ago, and it's got a lot of views. So check that out. A lot of great pictures in that one. And then just recently, a couple days ago, I put the 1966 Mr. Olympia report, which was from Iron Man magazine, written by Franklin Page. And that's also turning out to be a big hit. A lot of people are checking that out as well. Jerry and I did an interview earlier in the year where we were doing our end of the year reviews, and we did 1993. So I've got 1993 part one up. This is where we discussed all the big amateur shows from 1993, including the MPC USA, the MPC Nationals, and we also talk about the Teen Nationals that year, which was won by Branch Warren with Jay Cutler in second place. I've also got an Arnold interview from 1978 up on my YouTube channel. That was another popular one that came from Muscle Digest magazine as well. And then just today, I put up an article about Casey Viator when he won the 1970 Teenage Mr. America, the year before he won the Mr. America in 1971 at 19 years old, the youngest guy to ever win Mr. America. So a lot of great stuff up on my YouTube channel. So be sure to check that out, guys, under my name, John Hansen. Just go to my channel and see all these new videos that we got up. I also want to mention my summer shape up special. If anyone is looking to get in shape for the summer and you need some help, I will design your workout and your diet program. And this is up on my website, johnhansenfitness.com. And as you go to the page, you'll see right there on the front page, the Summer Shape Up Special. You can save $150 off a three-month program where I will write up your diet and your workout program. And I will also check in with you each week. I will be your coach for the full 3 months. So if you want to take advantage of that program, just go to johnhansenfitness.com and I will get you in shape for the summer. I am doing the same for myself too, shooting for a July 4th deadline to try to get in shape. So if you need any help with that, just go to my website, johnhansenfitness.com. All right. Just got the news today that OJ Simpson passed away. And I heard from Rick Wayne, because Rick actually knew OJ personally. He used to train with him at Vince's gym back in the 1970s. So Rick just wrote a recollection of his memories of O.J. Simpson, and it appeared in his newspaper, in the St. Lucia newspaper that Rick writes for. So he sent me a link to that. So that was very interesting. It's funny, Rick used to train with Robert Blake, who used to be on the show Beretta, of course. And then he also trained with Carl Weathers, who unfortunately also passed away just like a couple months ago. And of course, Carl Weathers was Apollo Creed in the Rocky movie. So next time we talk to Rick, we'll have to get some more of his stories from Vince's gym. And hopefully that interview will be coming up soon. I thought I was going to be able to interview Rick last week, but he had some guests coming in from out of town, so he wasn't able to do it. So hopefully we'll get him on the show in another couple of weeks. I also talked to Tim Belknap. Remember Tim Belknap, the first freaky bodybuilder from the 1980s? Tim won the 1981 Mr. America contest and finally got in contact with Tim. He is on Instagram now. So I reached out to him, told him I wanted to do an interview with him, and he said he agreed, but then he said, I'm busy with work, so I'll let you know. So hopefully it'll happen soon, but I'm going to keep bugging Tim. And I knew Tim, and I saw those contests that he went in way back before he won the Mr. America, including the 1980 Mr. Illinois contest, which was held in Illinois. I saw that contest. And also the 1981 Mr. Midwest contest, where he created a sensation. He was unbelievable. 5'4", 216 pounds. Incredible physique for way back then, especially. And then later that year, of course, he went to Las Vegas and he won the Mr. America contest as a light heavyweight. So, yeah, I know Tim's history, so it would be a great interview. And I hope we can do an interview with him soon. So keep your fingers crossed on that one. So, yeah, nothing really happening on the interview front, but I'll keep trying. Got a few guys that I'm looking to and I'm calling and I'm getting in contact with. So hopefully that'll happen soon. All right. I didn't get any emails from you guys. If you guys are interested in emailing me about this show or any other show, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I will read your emails on the air. All right. Well, let's get started with these articles. I want to share these with you. It's pretty fascinating stuff going back in history to the 1940s, 1950s, and the 1960s. So this first article I got, it came from actually a muscle builder. It was the January 1978 issue of Muscle Builder, and they had a series of articles, and they would run them every couple of months, called It Happened 30 Years Ago. And this one was written by Mark Wolf, and it says, Steve Reeves wins 1947 Mr. America. So it says, it was during the social-economical boom of post-war America that this country elected one of bodybuilding's most popular names to the title of Mr. America. In 1947, the contest was only 7 years old, the first in 1940 going to John Grimmick, and actually the first Mr. America was 1939, and that was won by Burt Goodrich. And it says the 1947 version proved a thriller, with the show going up for grabs between Reeves and the most muscular man in America, Eric Peterson. The two were tied at 72 points apiece, but when the final pose down put Steve on top, America quite unknowingly provided the spark that would make Steve the most singled out pioneer in bodybuilding history. At 20 years of age, Steve Reeves was Mr. America with nowhere to go but up. But the determination that would lead him to Hollywood recognition a few years later was not a spontaneous nova of talent. Steve was a hard work come honest reward type that began ardent physical training as a youngster in Oakland, California. As a teenager, Steve showed physical crave by being the only one of his fellow newspaper carrier friends that could ride his bike up the steep Californian hills. He had a golden arm and could hit a doorbell with a folded paper while careening down Oakland's more severe escarpments. He even developed his own walk, raising up on the toes with each step, utilizing as much of the calf muscle as possible. Steve's paper route was an extra means of helping the family financial situation, but Steve had no idea then just how important that part-time job would turn out to be. While wrist wrestling with some of the other news carriers in his area, Steve was defeated only once. The loss hurt him, and he decided to investigate the physically smaller competitor who had beaten him. The idea fascinated him immediately when Steve found the boy training with weights one day when he visited him. Steve started training at once and soon had his own bodybuilding system organized. Later, when he commenced attending high school, he had the good fortune to go to Castlemont High, one of the only schools at the time offering weight room facilities. The interest grew until he felt he needed more expert advice on some of the crucial aspects of bodybuilding. He then joined Yerrick's gym in Oakland, and he trained until he weighed 190 pounds. He was 19 years old. Steve, upon graduating from high school, joined the Army in 1944 and was sent to the Philippines. The move was good and bad. Steve received many awards and certificates for combat duty, but he fell to hospitalization when he contracted malaria, a condition that would recur until Steve was sent to Japan, 20 pounds underweight and eager on getting some kind of gym system worked up. It had been 2 years since his last workout, but after finding an interpreter and the proper people to provide the equipment, Steve was back into overt bodybuilding and even had a few of his buddies training alongside. Upon his return to America in the fall of 1946, Steve resumed training at Yerrick's gym, and he trained steady with Ed Yerrick until he went to Portland, Oregon, unannounced one Saturday, only to return with a Mr. Pacific Coast trophy under his arm. Steve remained in training. This time, more and more people were watching. In 1947, he again took the Mr. Pacific Coast award, along with best arms, chest, and legs. The buildup in the press was terrific, and the heat was on. By the time Steve swiped Mr. America 1947 title away from a muscular Eric Peterson, few were surprised. The Mr. America contest was Steve's greatest accomplishment. He had nipped a closely matched Eric Peterson and left third spot Joe Laureano, 1945 Junior Mr. America, and 1947 Mr. America Best Abdominals in the wake of his 1947 win. Steve went on to leave his mark on bodybuilding as the best-known muscle builder of the day. He endorsed the Weider system, Weider weights, and wrote a series of 12 articles for his friend Joe Weider. Today, Steve is still known as the immortal giant of righteousness and men of men, Hercules. Over a dozen films bearing the Steve Reeves brand of Hercules are even today unmatched. The films were classics, and the Steve Reeves image lives on. All right, kind of a shorter article. So I did find another article looking through the internet, and I found this one from Iron Man magazine, the fall of 1947. This was written by Iron Man owner Perry Rader. And it says, Mr. America Contest 1947, excerpts from the Senior National Championships, which was the weightlifting contest that they held with the Mr. America, and the Mr. America Contest. In the following story, we have tried to give you a word picture of the Senior National Lifting Championships and the Mr. America contest so that you, who did not have the privilege of attending, can thrill to some of the experiences that we had. On the night of June 25th, the editor left Alliance, Nebraska, on a journey to view one of the greatest events in the lifting history of the USA, the National Weightlifting Championships of 1947, which were held at the beautiful and spacious auditorium of Lane Tech High School on Western Avenue and Addison Street in Chicago. We had long anticipated this event being one of the best due to the great interest recently developed in our sport. We were not disappointed and came away wishing that more of you had been there to enjoy the meet. However, we are going to try to give you the story of the championships by word and picture, also a story of the Mr. America. It was necessary that I leave a day early on the train due to the floods between here and Chicago, which had washed out much of the track. I traveled over considerable detours, and your editor arrived in Chicago that day before the meet was to begin, or at about noon on June the 27th. Mrs. Rader, who usually goes to meets and helps so much, was unable to attend because of duties here at home. Therefore, I was lost without her companionship. I at once went out to Lane Tech High School and looked over the wonderful layout available for this meet. This school takes up several city blocks and has a tremendous and beautiful lawn in front that the contestants made good use of during the day and sunbathing and posing for the photographers who swarm the place. I heard one fellow remark that there must have been 1,000 people on the lawn watching the contestants pose and taking photos. A record number of pictures were probably taken of this event this year. We will probably be showing some of them to you for some time. This high school, we understand, is the largest in the world, and they have so many graduates each year that graduation exercises must be held on the athletic field. It is filled with all kinds of machinery and special equipment for teaching young men vocations that they might follow the work life they choose. It's our belief that if we had more such schools, we would have fewer misfits in our social life, and that a high school education would mean something other than just a diploma. Mr. John Dulce, the meet director, and all his helpers did a wonderful job in preparing for and conducting the meet. Norbert Grubber, auditor of Chicago Bodybuilder, was in evidence at all times, helping out wherever he could. Mr. Dulce, as chairman of weightlifting of the Central District, had his committee busy most of the time. Too much credit cannot be given them for a difficult job well done. We believe that in many ways it was one of the best conducted meets in America. After a look at the location of the meet, I rushed back downtown to hunt a room, and none too soon, it seems, but I finally found one at the huge YMCA hotel, which has about 3,000 rooms, but is usually full. Some of the other boys who found rooms elsewhere were evicted to make room for another convention scheduled in Chicago at the same time. The next day for the meet was scheduled to start at 3 p.m., but the competitors were on hand early, as were the Mr. America contestants, who obligingly stripped and posed for the newsreel men and other photographers. To help decorate the scene, several models from the Patricia Stevens agency were on hand. Ordinarily, these beautiful girls would be quite an attraction, but it was to be noticed that when the muscle men came around, the enthusiasts crowded around them with all thought of beautiful gals gone from their mind. You will see some of these attractive young ladies in pictures illustrating this article. Before the meet started, Mr. Wortman called his committee and officials together to discuss rules and regulations for the meet, as well as discuss the world championships to be held in the latter part of September. This big event is coming to this country for the first time through the efforts and financial support of Bob Hoffman. Every barbell man and weight enthusiast owes it to the game, his country, and Bob to put every effort behind the big meet. Talk it up. Try to get others to attend, and be sure to attend it yourself. We'd like to see and meet all of you there. After this meeting, the weighing in of the athletes for the afternoon event took place. By the time this was over, it was time for the meet to begin. Sunday, June 29th. Sunday was certainly a big day. The large number of boys went to church in the morning, but by noon they began to gather at the Lane Tech High School, taking pictures, become acquainted, and visiting. Many of the greats of the muscle world were there, and such an array of might and muscle has probably never gathered in one spot before. There was Bob Hoffman, who acted as master of ceremonies part of the time, while Joseph A. Paul acted the rest of the time. Mr. Paul is a hard worker in the Central District on all phases of the iron game. Dietrich Wortman, our hardworking chairman, has done a great deal for our game these many years and leaves his large business a great deal that he might attend the meets and conventions of the game that is dear to his heart. He's developed a great deal of lifting talent in his metropolitan district. There was Lon, the man who supplies the magazines with the beautiful photographs, George Quintance, who does the artwork for Your Physique and Muscle Power, Burt Goodrich, the first Mr. America, and his wife, Al Berger, bigger than ever, he looks like a giant, and why doesn't someone get him into competitive lifting? Chet Teagarden, associate editor for Ironman and proprietor of Strong Barbell Company, the great John Grimmick, Steve Stanko, bigger and better than ever, J.C. Heiss with some new theories on bodybuilding, Alan Steven and his wife, the former Miss Legionnaire. Alan is now quite busy with his new bodybuilding studio in Minneapolis and looks even better than he did last year when he won the title. Ray Van Cleef was there and busy with his work as associate editor of Strength and Health. Gord Venables taking photos of everyone. I recall Gord's wonderful squat snatching of a few years ago. Leo Stern of San Diego taking care of his boys from the West Coast. Leo has a wonderful gym that he operates with his partner, Henry Fletcher, in San Diego. We'll have a lot to say of these boys when we write about our trip up to the West Coast. Harry Bosco Peschel and his wife were on hand, as was Jack Libatori, who acted as master of ceremonies for the Mr. America contest. Charles A. Ramsey, that great trainer of colored lifting championships, was on hand. Mr. Ramsey spends much of his time traveling for a large banking firm, but is now training some boys in New York. This man was once one of the world's greatest wrestlers and has wrestled every 4 hours in a match with the champion George Botner. He trained on weights for many years in England with such famous athletes as Sandow, Saldo, and others of like caliber. Tony Terlazzo was there and looking fine. Too bad that Tony can't lift for the USA in the coming world championships, as we need a good lightweight. All these and many others were present. We regret we do not have room to mention names of all of them and tell you something of them, but we just can't give more room to this issue. Mr. America contest. All the posing had been done on the huge lawn in front of the high school building had evidently been good advertising, because on Sunday evening, the big auditorium was nearly filled. The stage lighting had been carefully arranged by Al Urban, the master physique photographer of Chicago. The muscular development of each contestant could be shown to best advantage this year. New rules formulated by the AAU were used this year and running off the event, and it must be said that the entire show was smooth compared to other years. A nice platform was provided for each contestant to pose on. As Jack Libitori, the master of ceremonies, called the name of each contestant, he came out from the wings and onto the platform under the carefully arranged lights and was allowed three poses of his own choice of 15 seconds each. In this manner, the large number of contestants were quickly run through. All judges appointed by the national chairman, Mr. Dietrich Wortman, sat down in front where they could have an excellent view. All selections were made by points, and a card system was used for the tabulations. After the men had all posed, a number were called back to pose again, and two in particular who were tied, Reeves and Peterson. Although the audience had not been told what they tied for, they had guessed that it was for the Mr. America title and not for some of the subdivisions. Most certainly it was a problem to choose between these two magnificent physiques. Peterson, who won the Mr. California title a short time ago, is a blonde giant who was almost perfection of development. Earl Lederman, who was a good personal friend of Sandow, tells me that Eric greatly reminds him of the great Eugene Sandow. He has beautiful abdominal formation. His arms are unbelievable, especially the biceps, which appear to be two baseballs placed on top of the other. His deltoids and pectorals leave little to be desired. His separation is unequaled. Eric is only 18 now and has his eye on next year's contest, which he plans to be better than ever. Steve Reeves, on the other hand, is a brunette with a dark tan and is somewhat taller than Eric. He has a tremendous breadth of shoulder, perhaps the widest appearing we have ever seen. His hips appear slender, although they actually are not, compared to the other men, but it is his wide shoulders that make him appear so. Here is a man who looks the part in his street clothes as well as under the lights posing. Many people are greatly impressed with the shape and development of his entire leg. He has very fine calves. His posing routine is very good. He has a pleasing smile and stage personality. The judges found it impossible to choose between these two, and they gave each 72 points out of a possible 75. Thus, it was necessary to vote for the Mr. America, and in the vote, Steve won. Steve also won the Best Back Award. His back is very wide and is superbly developed, as photos will show of him indicate. Eric Peterson won the title Most Muscular Man, as well as the Most Muscular Arms. In talking to him after the show, he seemed very well pleased with these awards, as if he had won the Mr. America title. Score for Most Muscular Man title was 30 points for Peterson and 29 for Reeves, so here again, they almost tied. Joe Laureano again won Best Abdominals. He certainly has a magnificent abdominal development. His rectus abdominis muscles are very thick. His external oblique muscles form great rolls of muscle around the crest of the ilium or hip bone. Joe seemed to be more massive and shapely than ever before, and is a great favorite with the audience. He placed third in the Mr. America contest. John Frobotnick was better than ever this year, showing more muscle mass than ever, and his chest seemed even deeper and more heavily muscled than last year, if that were possible. Again, he won the Best Chest Award and fourth place at the Mr. America. George Eferman of Philadelphia won fifth place in the Mr. America and probably had the heaviest pectoral development of anyone there. They look especially large when you're standing close to them. They must be 2.5 inches in depth. After the posing and while the points were being counted, last year's Mr. America, Alan Steven, came on stage and thrilled the audience with his amazing development and magnetic personality. He and his beautiful wife both posed for the photographers. Then he and his wife and Steve Reeves posed together. Another popular athlete and the first Mr. America came on and displayed his fine physique in some well-selected poses. Burt Goodrich still retains his fine development and gets bigger each year, even though he's no longer a young man and he can't devote as much time to his training as he used to. His fine gym, where Peterson, Field, Lederman, and others train, keeps him quite busy. His wife, who was a school teacher in Hollywood, was with him and they were making a trip of the country in their new car. Another favorite, Mr. America, Steve Stanko, came up and gave a very impressive posing exhibition. Never have we seen more impressive arms on anyone. They are unbelievable. Steve has put up a great fight to develop his super physique and is to be congratulated. The audience called for Grimmick at intervals throughout the evening, and finally John came to the mic and explained that he preferred not to pose at the Mr. America meets because of the hard feelings that might sometimes be caused, and that he preferred to sit in the audience and enjoy the show with the rest of the boys. Too many people fail utterly to understand John's position. Two very good balancing and dancing acts were presented after the show during the tabulation of points. We almost forgot to mention that J.C. Heiss followed Grimmick on the stage, and taking off his shirt, he displayed his massiveness. There was no doubt but what he has the widest back there that night. As Joe says, I haven't the shape of the other boys, but I sure got size and mass. Joe weighed about 275, which is some poundage at his height of 5 feet 10. After the event was officially over, many still remain with the newsreel men, and photographers exposed a great deal of film on the competitors and the Patricia Stevens models. These girls are to be commended for their patience and charm. They sat on the big stage throughout the entire event and then posed for photographs until almost midnight, when everyone left happy and joyous at having seen one of the greatest shows of strength and physical perfection ever presented. Wow, that's crazy. 36 competitors in the contest. All right. Wow, what a blast from the past. Oh, different things were back then. All right, I want to read another one. This one is from the, as I said, the 1948 Mr. Universe contest. So many people believe this was the first NABBA Mr. Universe, but really it wasn't a NABBA contest. It was actually held because the Olympics were being held in London that year in 1948. So whoever the organization was, I'm not sure, I don't think it was the AAU. I'll read the article and maybe we'll find out. But they put this contest together because of the Olympic Games being held in London that year. And then there was no Mr. Universe contest held the next year in 1949. So then in 1950, they did start a Mr. Universe contest in London. And this was the first official NABBA Mr. Universe, which I'm going to read about that in a second. But first, I want to read this one, which was from Strength and Health magazine from the October 1948 issue. It says, the Mr. Universe contest by George Walsh, chairman of Mr. Universe judges. John Grimmick was crowned Mr. Universe at the Scala Theatre, London, last month by an international panel of judges, supported unanimously by an international audience. But it was Steve Reeves, the man he had just beaten in open competition, who gave him the proudest title of all, when after the decision had been announced, Mr. America 1947 stepped up to the microphone and declared, quote, I think that John Grimmick is the greatest bodybuilder who ever lived, unquote. Steve's frank confession was a sportsmanlike action, but that his opinion was shared by the physical culture leaders of a score of different countries who were present was shown by the thunderous applause. I have never known an audience so enthusiastic, nor one so united in its enthusiasm. Here in Britain, we've had a few opportunities of staging large-scale physique contests during the past 10 years for obvious reasons, although we've been holding them at intervals ever since Eugene Sandow ran his competitions more than half a century ago. So Eugene Sandow ran the first official bodybuilding contest, and that was in 1901 in London. We seized on the occasion of the Olympic Games to hold a Mr. Universe contest because we knew that many of the world's best-built men would already be in London, and some world-famous authorities who might be asked to act as judges would also be visiting Britain at the same time. We thought that some of the new physical culture countries like New Zealand, Australia, and Burma would be glad to have their representatives see the world's best developed men gathered together in competition. We knew that our audience would be the most international crowd ever assembled for such an occasion, including athletes from nearly 60 different nations. We planned the Mr. Universe competition very carefully and impartially. I was asked to act as chairman of the judges panel, and I'm glad of the opportunity of stating that I could not have had a more internationally representative and respected group to serve with me. The whole physical culture world honors and reveres George Hackenschmidt. George, now a veteran of more than 70 years, is only a legend to the modern bodybuilder, but all who know him personally are aware of his scientific analysis and all that goes into the making of physical perfection. As our first judge, George was universally acceptable. Tromp van Diggelen, the famous South African physical culture authority, who was the discoverer of Maxick and Hermann Gorner, and who in the early years of the century made an endeavor to match Arthur Saxon with Joseph Steinbach, was the second judge to be invited. Tromp flew 7,000 miles to act as judge in the Mr. Universe competition, a gesture and a sacrifice that was well appreciated. Monsieur Eriks of Paris is believed to have photographed more physiques than any man in the world. He has been a physical culturist for nearly 40 years and is invariably an official at European physique competitions. When it was found that Professor Dubonnet, who had just celebrated his 80th birthday, was not able to make the journey to London, Monsieur Eriks was the obvious substitute. Dr. Bankoff is a famous Russian surgeon, but also a weightlifter and trainer of weightlifters. Dr. Bankoff sacrificed a great deal of time in acting as a judge in the Mr. Universe competition. Bob Hoffman was to have completed our panel of judges, a panel which I consider to be the most representative ever assembled for a physique contest. But Bob declined. When it was known that John Grimmick was making the journey, the American lifting coach declared that he would prefer not to act, as John is a York man and it could happen that criticism would be made. We would like to have had another member of the American Olympic Party take Bob's place, somebody like Ray Van Cleef or Johnny Turpak, who have had more than sufficient years in the business to qualify them as authorities. But, and it is much to their credit, they all declined to officiate in a contest in which one of their particular friends was participating. With all respected and admired their scruples in this matter, although personally I did not consider them necessary, a physical culture teacher cannot remain in the public eye for 10 or 15 years without all the men who matter getting to know whether he is a genuine or impartial enthusiast or simply a man of business. And if Bob Hoffman or Ray Van Cleef had been a judge in the Mr. Universe competition, there couldn't surely have been any criticisms. My own opinion is that John would have been rather handicapped by the backbend Bob or Ray got in endeavoring to be 101% impartial. We tried to find another American with sufficient knowledge and experience to justify selection, and for my part, I wouldn't have cared if he had been a particular friend of Steve Reeves, so long as his integrity was unquestioned. Some of my fellow judges were astonished to learn that no such man was available. I was a little surprised myself. I had been reading quite a lot about physique and bodybuilding associations springing up on the American continent. I thought I remembered that one of them was not only American, but international. Either the 1948 Olympic Games weren't important enough to warrant the attendance of members from these bodies, or the term international applies to their claims and not to their activities. There was no American in London whose status in the physique world justified the organizers in inviting him to officiate. And so George Greenwood, one of Europe's leading authorities in bodybuilding, was invited to fill the remaining place. An intricate system of awarding points was hammered out at several preliminary meetings, although I made it quite clear to all the judges that they were not to be bound by it, but must base their ultimate verdicts upon their experience and convictions. The first class, the competition, was arranged for four different height groups, and the winners and runner-up in each class competed in the finals, was for those under the height of 5'5" 3/4". Only on the occasion of the Olympic Games, with athletes from the smaller stature countries present, could a class of this nature be well represented. Namajo, the bantamweight world record holder from Iran, was a popular winner of this class, and his physique is truly impressive. A Britisher, Dan Dorans, was the runner-up, beating competitors from India, South Africa, Burma, Belgium, and Northern Ireland. The next class, from men 5'6" to 5'8" 3/4", gave the crowded theater its first glance of John Grimmick, and what a welcome John received. It wasn't just Grimmick's physique that made 1,000 or so enthusiasts from a score of different countries rise to their feet and give him the greeting of his life. For all the Britishers present and for most of the foreigners, John Grimmick has been, for years, a symbol and an inspiration. Grimmick has proved himself a strong man. He has lasted in the physique world for more than 15 years. The men who acclaimed John Grimmick's first appearance on the stage of the Scala Theater weren't novices or masculine bobby soxers. They gave him a terrific ovation largely because they appreciated the inspirational value of his work over the last 15 years. And win or lose, they wanted him to know something of their feelings in the matter. John's posing, it is hardly necessary to add, brought a further volume of applause. I thought personally that John was a little listless at the stage. He took the class honors easily enough, but André Drap, the current Mr. France, gave a rather more lively display and rightly gained some well-earned applause. He was an obvious second to Grimmick. The third class, 5'9" to 5'11" 3/4", produced nothing extraordinary. The present Mr. Britain, Charles Jarrett, emerging as the winner, followed by E. White of London. The big class, men over 6 feet, gave the crowd its first sight of Steve Reeves, And once again, as he appeared and ran through his poses, there was a demonstration of enthusiasm. The audience gave him a terrific reception, and one I thought was well-deserved. Steve was a super build, and the international crowd that watched him were not at all slow to show their appreciation. There was no doubt at all about the winner of this particular division, but even so, Steve didn't have matters all his own way. Heidenstam, who won the Plus Bell Athlete de Europe contest back in 1939, is superbly proportioned. And Martin, last year's Mr. London, can control his 18-inch upper arms and 50-inch chest better than most. Martin was given second place in the class, but as the margin was so close, it was decided to allow Heidenstam to take part in the final judging. So nine men, Namdeju, Dorans, Grimmick, Drapp, Jarrett, White, Reeves, Martin, and Heidenstam, took the stage individually and together for the semifinal parade. And never before have I heard an audience let itself go so wholeheartedly over the group of muscle men. While the heavyweight class of the British Empire Weightlifting Championships was being decided, the judges made their final decisions. Each of them handed me a folded slip, given their selection for first, second, and third place, and it was agreed that I should not reveal the name of the winner until after the top three had appeared on the stage again. Not even the judges themselves knew at this stage who had been chosen Mr. Universe. And at this point, is rather important because some people might have thought that the judges were influenced by Grimmick's wonderful display of posing and muscle control, which brought the evening to a close. The verdict was actually reached before the top three scoring men went on again, although nobody but myself knew what it was. We had decided to give the stage to each man in turn for a period of 3 minutes during which he could do exactly as he pleased. Drapp lost the toss, and the crowd rose to him as he went through a fine posing and agility routine. The applause he received was nothing to the absolute roar of approval that was sustained all the time Grimmick was on stage, giving his incomparable posing and muscle control show. In a lifetime of watching every kind of sporting event, I have never known such a demonstration. As John's great display came to an end, men stood on their seats and shouted themselves hoarse. Steve had an advantage of appearing last, and he too had a terrific reception as he ran through his poses again, but the man has not been born who could have followed Grimmick's great display without suffering a little by comparison. When I announced that John Grimmick was Mr. Universe 1948 with Steve Reeves runner-up and Andre Drapp in third place, the great international audience gave the decision a wholehearted approval. The judges have asked me not to make public their own individual selections and point awards, and naturally I shall honor their request. It's only fair to John, however, to state that he won the title by a decisive margin. With representatives from 16 different countries taking part, this was a real Mr. Universe competition in every sense of the word, and the USA should be proud that she took first and second places. When Bob Hoffman was called to the microphone, what a genuine regard lifters and athletes of all nations have for the genial editor of this magazine. He paid a fine tribute to Steve Reeves and pointed out that he is still a youngster with a great career in front of him. Steve himself put into words what everybody present was thinking, that John Grimmick was a worthy winner of the Mr. Universe title because he is, beyond the shadow of a doubt, the greatest bodybuilder who ever lived. Wow. It's too bad there's no video footage of John Grimmick ever posing. I think there's some of Steve Reeves, but I never saw any of John Grimmick because every article I've ever read always talks about John Grimmick as this unbelievable poser, and it would be interesting to see what they think is great posing back then. I'm sure it's different than what we have today. I know John did a lot of muscle display, like we would do a vacuum and things like that, so it'd be interesting to see what that was. All right, now I've got another one here, and this actually came from one of the early Muscle Mag International contests. It was actually issue number 2, which was, let me see if I have a date on this, 1975 April. And it was actually a reprint from Health and Strength magazine in England, which was probably reprinted from 1950 when the contest took place. So like I said, this was the very first official NABBA Mr. Universe where Steve Reeves won. It says the 1950 Mr. Universe contest, written by George Walsh, reprinted courteous of Health and Strength magazine in England. May I introduce the good friends and famous physical culturists who are serving with me on the judging panel of this greatest ever physique show, the 1950 Mr. Universe competition. On my immediate right, as we sit here in the ballroom of the Royal Hotel, ready to commence our preliminary adjudication, is the doyen of strongmen, George Hackenschmidt, a legendary figure to the young enthusiast, but a very real and very lovable character to those of us who know him well. The Russian Lion is fully prepared for many hours of painstaking comparison and selection. On Hack's right sits Professor Craye of Belgium, a continental physical culture authority of long experience and vast enthusiasm. And to the right of Craye, strategically placed so that he can dart away with his camera whenever he thinks it's necessary, is the world-famous physique photographer friend of all bodybuilders, Arex of Paris. It's impossible to contemplate an important European physique contest without the presence of Arex as an observer or a judge. And today I know from past experience, he will be working harder than any competitor, giving scrupulous attention to the rendering of his decisions and capturing, like the true artist that he is, many memorable photographic impressions for the delight of the myriad enthusiasts who cannot witness the competition. On my immediate left is George Greenwood, a friend and advisor of bodybuilders in the world over, and an experienced through, though not in years, the most veteran of all physique judges. And on George's left is André Boulard, the official delegate of the French Federation of Physical Culture. Mr. Boulard is an adjudicator of lengthy experience, and his fellow judges will soon discover that he is meticulous in forming his judgments as he is charming in presenting them. On the extreme left sits Alexander Karali of Egypt, a professional physical culturist of many years standing and principal of the largest training center in the Middle East. I know from experience that Karali is most scrupulous in the forming of his opinions, and I anticipate with a slight touch of apprehension, since time is not unlimited and 50 men must be appraised, the possibility of some delayed decisions from this official. I'm quite certain, however, that once made, Karali's decisions will be positive and irrevocable, and with this assurance in mind, I am less apprehensive on the matter of the time schedule. Here then, ready for action, is my panel of international judges, six of the most famous names in physical culture, prepared to decide the destiny of the greatest of all physique titles. And here, marshaled in a position by the editor who finds himself compelled to accept the duty simply because he is the one person who knows each competitor, comes the first group lineup, the 14 competitors in the Class 4 division. What an imposing spectacle they present. Not even the harsh daylight, we are criticized in some quarters because we require competitors to appear before us initially without the aid of artificial lighting, which can emphasize strong points and camouflage weak ones. But we think we are right. Destroys the impressiveness of these mighty little men. They stand before us for 10 minutes in a natural, unposed, but a uniform, heels-together position. They turn around so that we may view them from the rear. And now, Arex and Hack have asked that the first seven in the lineup shall change places with the last seven so that the judges shall view them all from front and rear from an exactly central position. Now comes the presentation before us of each individual competitor to show himself to his best advantage. And I note that my judges have all exhausted the first of their official judging sheets and are busily engaged upon the second. Now that the individual presentation is completed, some competitors see our little limited and posing repertoire, while others are overgenerous, although in fact, neither characteristic will influence the ultimate decision. I shall ask my judges for their list of the six finalists. Here are the judges' sheets before me, and it requires only a few moments of calculation to find that Brady, Dorans, Hamilton, Levy, Rogers, and Sellers have qualified for the final placings. I inform the judges, one or two of them, of course, have recorded a vote for other competitors, that these six are the qualifiers and that from these six, they must now select the class winner. The voting in this case takes very little time, and without the necessity of recording my own casting decision, I have decided to refrain from voting unless it's necessary. I am able to announce that Dorans is the winner. It's obviously superfluous, but it gives me a great deal of pleasure to tell my judges that had my vote been necessary, it would certainly have been given to Don. So the declaration, quite confidential to the judges at this stage, that a Britisher had won the first round is a very pleasant duty. Now comes the task of placing the men who occupy the other finalists in order of merit. We, the judging panel, know that eight of these splendid men are already eliminated, but the army of enthusiasts waiting to see them on the stage at the Scala Theater tonight will want a glimpse of them all, and we are anxious too that the whole physical culture world shall see the men we have rejected. So once again, every competitor is appearing before us, none knowing whether he's qualified or what position he occupies. With the final sheets before me, the judges are required to record 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1 point to each of the remaining five finalists in order of descending merit. I see that I am required to make a casting vote only to separate two of the most remote place winners, Hamilton and Levy, although extremely close in final voting, are definitely second and third place winners. And here is the first lineup of Class 3 competitors, the men whose stature is between 5'6 and 5'8. Once again, daylight doesn't destroy my impression of collective massiveness, and Hack on my right exclaims that the muscularity of Kalinjiak and George Greenwood on my left has an involuntary whistle for the symmetry of Kutold and Ludens. Voting in this class is so close that I'm forced to participate. Ferrero emerges as a narrow winner, and after the individual presentation and final group lineup, Kalinjiak and Katula take narrowly disputed places. Eriks, Boulard, and Corrali have rather taken a disturbingly long time to reach their decisions on the final placings, but looking at the men again as they stand at the side of the room, how can I blame them for their careful and calculated deliberations? Here is Class 2 with three new names to be added to the judges' sheets as the competitors line up. Nasser, the winner of the official Mr. Egypt contest a few days ago and present as his country's representative, and Lees and Heidenstam of Britain, who on checking are found to be less than 5'11¾" and are therefore reclassified from Class 1. What a magnificent body of men. I am amazed that Heidenstam, at almost 40 years of age, should appear before us with greater bulk and cleaner definition than even in pre-war days. It's hard to believe that such young John Lees can have made such improvement since the 1949 Mr. Britain competition. Nasser is a magnificent specimen. Rube Martin's mighty torso seems incredibly to be more spectacular than ever, and the rest of the British boys, White, Knott, Jarrett, and Purser, all seem to have made improvement. Here's a stroke of luck for me. Although the voting is extremely close to the panel is positive in selection of John Lees as the class winner. What a triumph, and well-deserved, I think, for this up-and-coming young British bodybuilder. My good luck continues. Although the voting for the minor places is again extremely close, I'm called upon to decide only the most minor issue. And here is the big moment for which we've all waited so expectantly, the appearance before us of the Class 1 competitors, including the sole American challenger, Steve Reeves, and Britain's great hope, Reg Park. How nice and how British a gesture it is that the editor should lead a round of applause for each of these outstanding bodybuilders as they face us for the first time. With the class reduced to four, charming Georges Dardan of Belgium and Hubert Thomas, the reigning Mr. Wales, are the other two, it is, of course, unnecessary for us to follow any process of elimination. But our task is nonetheless heavy, for as they stand before us individually and together and display their stupendous physiques in pose after pose of breathtaking splendor, who could easily separate the mighty American from the awe-inspiring Britisher? In a short interval, the men are to be called back again in a moment. Each judge now informs me that regardless of all other class winners, first and second place in the Supreme Mr. Universe competition itself must rest, so far as they are concerned, between Reeves and Park. I'm not surprised, but I find myself wishing at this moment, as the two men appear before us yet again, that others might share my responsibility, for it might easily happen now or later in the evening when final decisions are taken, that the judging panel is equally divided, leaving me the task of choosing Mr. Universe. And my confidence, for if the judging is decisive at this stage and it is not subsequently changed, I alone shall know which of the two is to be the supreme winner. We follow the four competitors to the special stage where photographs are to be taken, and it's obvious to me, even at this stage, that several of my judges are not yet decided. Corrali, forgetful of dignity, crouches down to the floor to gain a new perspective of the two principal contenders as they stand together before the cameras. Greenwood holds the tableau motionless for a few moments and advances for a ruthless and intimate inspection. Craigie, I see, is wedged into the far corner to secure a different angle of observation. As for me, and against the possibilities I dislike to contemplate, I am at one moment crouching on my heels with Corrali. Then I'm huddled in the corner with Craigie, and now, at the end, I'm standing behind the camera with Eriks. It's over at last, and here in my hand are the judges' final decisions. No one judge knows how the others have voted. It is, in any case, a tentative decision with the right to alter it at the show itself if the individual judge so wishes. There's an hour or so before the great show commences, time for a bath, a change of clothes, and a hasty sandwich. I'm grateful for the break, but deep within me is the apprehension, I can think of no more appropriate word, that fate might call me again to cast my vote for the greatest of all physique titles. All my judges are here at the theater in good time, and a hasty conference is convened in the dressing rooms to decide upon procedure. We have cast our votes for the winners and finalists in each of the three junior classes, junior, of course, only in respect of height scales, and these are irrevocable. We've decided that the winner of Class 1 shall be the winner of the Mr. Universe title, and that the runner-up in the same class shall enjoy second place. There remains for us, therefore, only the selection between Reeves and Park, and the election from the remaining class winners, or, of course, the third place winner in Class 4, the third position in the Supreme Contest itself. So they're not going to judge the winners of each class. They have decided after the prejudging that Reeves and Park are going to be 1 and 2. The crowd is giving us all a great reception as we are introduced from the stage with, need I say, a particularly warm welcome for the great George Hackenschmidt. The competitors from the lighter classes, none of whom, of course, are aware of our previous decisions, are appearing one by one, and it seems to me that most of the audience agrees with the final six we've selected in each category. But everybody is waiting, of course, for the appearance of the two big shots of the competition, Park and Reeves. And so in great trepidation am I. Here before me, I have five completed judging sheets. Two of my judges have found it impossible to separate the American and the Britisher, and they've recorded a joint vote for each one. One had voted outright for Park, and two have voted outright for Reeves. If the remaining judge should decide for Park and none of the others decides to alter his decision, the unwelcome task of making a casting vote will descend upon me. I can hear the deafening applause that is greeting the appearance of Park and Reeves as they display their breathtaking poses before the world's most enthusiastic audience. How I wish I could be sitting up there in the gallery or with my wife and my son in the stalls. I marveled at these two supermen in the ruthless daylight of the afternoon. How much more would I have enjoyed their matchless posing beneath kind and cooperative overhead spotlighting? But I'm waiting now for confirmation or retraction from five of my judges, and first of all, it is the confirmation of the previous decisions that I received. Now for the last judge, who I see is approaching me from the wings. If his decision should be for the Britisher, it'll be my most unenviable task to render a casting vote. And although I'm ready to shoulder this responsibility, it is one which I would infinitely prefer to avoid. I am overwhelmingly relieved. Had it been my fate to have decided between these two great physical culturists, I should have cast a vote for Reeves. It is, I think, fair that I should now make this fact clear. But I am relieved of this responsibility. My sixth judge has declared his decision so that I am not compelled to render any sort of decision at all. I am not quite sure of the words I'm choosing, but to judge by the tumultuous applause that greets my halting phrases at the microphone, I imagine that the audience understands. What I'm trying to say is, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Universe of 1950, Steve Reeves of the United States. All right. So not much writing on the physiques themselves, more about the judging, but that was an interesting article. And that came from the 1950 issue of Health and Strength in England. And I believe that was also the first competition where the Eugene Sandow Trophy, it was actually the bronze trophy that was given in the original Eugene Sandow contest of 1901. So Eugene Sandow gave three Sandow statues to his first three place winners in his contest. He gave a gold to first place, a silver Sandow statue to second place, and a bronze Sandow statue in third place. So at this first NABBA Mr. Universe in 1950, Steve Reeves received a bronze Sandow statue. And that's where Arnold got the idea to start giving that trophy to the Mr. Olympia winners, which they started doing in 1977 when Frank Zane won. So I'll do a little history there for you guys. All right. So let's go to the 60s now. Let's go to the very first Mr. Olympia contest. This is one of our favorite writers, Rick Wayne, and it's called The Night Larry Scott Conquered New York by Rick Wayne, author of The Body Men. What a night. Listen, the event had been widely publicized, the Mr. Olympia contest that would decide once and for all who really was the greatest bodybuilder in the world at a time when a host of greats were rusting away on crumpled laurels. Joe had conceived the contest as the one to settle all arguments, the one that would separate the men from the boys, so to speak, and the has-beens. Only the professionals would be eligible. Reg Park, John Grimmick, Bill Pearl, all the living legends were invited via Muscle Builder magazine to compete for the sport's highest honor, not to mention a winner-takes-all cash prize of $1,000. The fans held their collective breath. Here, indeed, was the contest of the year. The night came. The fans of Bill Pearl and Reg Park and the other greats of bodybuilding were sitting on the edge of their seats. They had jammed the Brooklyn Academy of Music on this steaming hot Saturday evening to witness history in the making. Yes, they were practically hanging from the rafters. For some, disappointment visited early with the news that Reg Park had not shown up, neither had Bill Pearl, and Grimmick had obviously thought better of the whole thing and decided to stay at home doing whatever he's been doing a whole lifetime back in York, Pennsylvania. But there were other champions, real red-blooded champions, and they were backstage, busy preparing, pumping up, leaving nothing to chance, just itching to get out there under the soft posing light, dying to settle the big question of that bodybuilding year. Earl Menard had posed and drawn warm applause. Minutes earlier, he had taken the Mr. Universe title in a close decision against Rick Wayne, but already he was a bodybuilding cliche. Chuck Sipes had also appeared, brought the house down, for he too had a magnificent physique, looked powerful. Doubtless he was the strongest bench presser in the house. Then it was Poole's turn, Harold Poole, on whose shoulders all of New York bodybuilding stood tall and proud. What a showman. He has been called Prince Poole, Damien, and Harry, which he hates. His fans are ubiquitous. In their hearts, they know they're in for yet another American black versus white contest. Here, it always boils down to that war of color whenever the combatants are ethnically dissimilar. Yes, tonight it will be black against white again. And the battle will continue among the fans long after the fallen champions have themselves gotten over their bruises of defeat. So now it's Harold's turn under the posing light. He transudes self-confidence, this six-footer so handsome in blue acrylic trunks. He knows there's a house full of black hope riding on him tonight. He can feel its psychic weight pressing down upon him. But his spirit will not bend. He has long grown accustomed to such pressures. From his early days with the AAU, when the best a black man could hope to achieve in bodybuilding was a second-place trophy in the Mr. America contest, he had carried black hope. Until finally his supporters, and say the truth, there were countless whites among the hordes, had prevailed upon him not to waste precious energy and time on bigots, and he had moved out of the AAU to join the International Federation of Bodybuilders. Since that time, Poole had been to black bodybuilding fans exactly and entirely as Muhammad Ali would be for black followers of boxing some years later, as Joe Louis was to them a generation earlier. He hit his best shot first, the most muscular pose. Poole was one of the first heavyweight bodybuilders in the world to display deep muscle striation and mass. Franco Colombo would arrive with a similar combination years later. Poole was a catalyst for outrageous behavior in the house. Screams! It seemed a busload of Beatle maniacs had somehow found their way into the Brooklyn Academy of Music. The noise grew louder with each successive incredible Poole pose. And then the star bowed, smiled, waved a delicately sculptured Michelangelo hand, and walked off in the dim light into the wings. Even before the MC announced the name of the next competitor, there was pandemonium at the Academy. Resplendent in blue mohair, Bud Parker started to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, from California, Larry..." The rest was drowned by the incredible noise in the auditorium. "Larry, Larry, Larry." What went on before, when Poole was on, was an English old lady's tea party compared to this, and all that before Scott has even shown himself. Then Bud Parker adds fuel to the already raging inferno of bodybuilding enthusiasm. He tries to trick this crazy, unreasonable, delirious, unruly mob into some semblance of normal behavior. Parker tells them that the star will not appear until they've quieted down to a reasonable level. Is Parker mad? Has he gone stark, raving bonkers? Does the ant order the aardvark to cease and desist? Does Tweety Bird bully Sylvester the cat? Now the audience goes berserk. 6,000 feet stomping together in some kind of cuckoo's nest unison, banging who knows what horror instruments against their seats, the theater walls, the floor, throwing paper cups and balled up programs at the Academy stage. Even the blacks have forgotten about their Prince Pool. Now they join the collective demand for the God from L.A. We want Scott, 2, 3, 4. We want Scott, 2, 3, 4. We want Scott. Christ, trust the blacks to introduce rhythm even to chaos. Still, the star does not appear. Larry Scott is indulging every bit of garbo in his veins. Let them want. Let them wait. Let them need. Meanwhile, Bud Parker has left the stage in search of Larry Scott. But Scott cannot be found. He seems to have disappeared. Oh, God, please. Has anyone seen Larry Scott? Already, desperation was warehousing in Bud Parker's liver. Where can Scott have disappeared to? He had not left the theater. He was standing quietly in a dark corner of the stage, in the wings, behind the curtains, savoring the mass hysteria that the mere thought of him had triggered off in New York, secure in the knowledge that no sane judging panel would dare deny him his right to the Mr. Olympia title that night. Already, even before he had entered the arena, he knew the Olympia money was his to collect, in his own sweet time. Larry, Larry, Larry. God, would they never stop? And then, before they fully realized it, Scott materialized on the posing rostrum, placing himself carefully to take full advantage of the posing light. Good grief. His is awesome. Greater by far than even his best pictures suggest. His skin is tanned orange-brown, that paper-thin skin that lets his abdominals, his amazing intercostals, the sharply defined serratus stand out, tantalizing hors d'oeuvres before the main course. The gold lame posing trunks fit like a second skin. Top to bottom, Larry Scott is impeccably turned out, a Beau Brummel with muscles yet. Every blonde hair is exactly in place. And the teeth, when he flashes that Scott smile, are straight out of fantasy land. The stuff of toothpaste advertisements, the essence of make-believe. But Larry Scott is no fantasy. He is as real as flesh is real, as palpable as the theater seats on which 3,000 agitated, restless behinds of diverse widths and hues are bouncing up and down like rubber balls on a hard tennis court. Ever so gracefully, he raises his arms, those amazing Scott biceps so thick and long and round and perfect, triceps thick as tugboat ropes, shifts his weight to his right leg. Christ, did you see that? The deltoid split. Dance, contract. What unspeakable volumes they transmit into your overloaded consciousness. The photographers scramble over the dumbfounded musicians in the orchestra pit like poor Bangladesh children after tourist American coins. Scott shifts again, bends slightly forward. His right hand meets his left. Clasp each other. Holy Mary, look how Larry's pectorals jump away from his chest. The photographers rain down on the musicians again. The straight ones from Muscle Builder and the other magazines, and the other kind, too. The audience that died of shock on his appearance is alive again. Larry Scott! Larry Scott! Mr. Olympia! They scream together as if directed by some hidden from view concert conductor in tails. Larry Scott! Larry Scott! Scott is now animated miracle, a never seen till now work of art by Michelangelo. Pose follows unbelievable pose, the last evoking still louder, more boisterous approval than the one before. By now, the judges in the front row seats know it would be suicidal to declare anyone else Mr. Olympia. 3,000 screaming, hoarse, abused, bleeding throats cannot be wrong. Mr. Olympia walks away from the rostrum. Unhurriedly, he strolls toward the wings, is swallowed up by the darkness, is oblivious of the booming, deafening, piercing screams for more, more. But there would be no more of Scott that night. Once a philosopher, twice a pervert, Scott would not return for another 12 months. The fans would have to wait until then for an encore. Garbo, eat your pumping little heart out. When finally Bud Parker returns to the mic, it is to announce a result that is already deja vu. Tonight, this is not the most regarding job in all of New York. So Scott, The great Scott is Mr. Olympia 1965, the first man ever to hold the title. He will repeat his devastating performance in 1966, beating Sergio Oliva in the process. And then he will go on to crucify 20,000 pubescent groupie hearts from New Jersey to the Isle of Man by announcing his retirement from competitive bodybuilding. He wanted to concentrate on being a good father and husband. There would be no time left for serious bodybuilding from here on. It says the foregoing has been reprinted from The Body Men by Ricky Wayne. For the full exciting story, get your copy today. All right. That was from the April-May 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine, written only as Rick Wayne can write. Fantastic. All right, I got one more short article here, guys. This is from the 1967 Mr. Olympia that Sergio Oliva won for the first time. And this was right after Larry Scott retired in 1966. And it said, "Bodybuilding's Finest Hour," by Rick Wayne, author of The Body Men. "In all the years that I've written about bodybuilding events and all the time I've been a fan, I have always been able to pull some appropriate words from the gray matter to fit each occasion. But now I am forced to admit I am at a loss to describe Sergio Oliva, for the appropriate words have not been coined. Let me say I may never again see such a display of muscle as long as I live. His musculature was an assault on believability. There was a time when he had size and shape, but lacked the clear-cut definition of pool. Things are different now. In just 1 year, Sergio has become the most phenomenal physical specimen I've ever laid eyes on. As he swung from one pose to the next, the excitement became almost violent. Hardly anyone could believe what they were seeing." This was written a little over 10 years ago by Dick Tyler, then a muscle builder feature writer, now a successful chiropractic doctor. How well one recalls the night. Indeed, it was also my big night, for I had earlier won the Mr. World title against some pretty stiff competition. Dave Draper, then at the peak of his career with both the Mr. America and Mr. Universe titles tucked under his belt, appeared unbeatable. He brought the house down. There were shouts of "Dave is immortal" from the audience, and certainly the blonde bomber looked like a god of Greek mythology. He was followed by Chuck Sipes, always a popular competitor, noted for his brute power, and Harold Poole. A year earlier, there were many who thought Harold had been at the receiving end of a raw deal when the title went to Larry Scott. Now all of New York's bodybuilding community seemed determined to will Harold to win this time around. And say the truth, Harold was incredible that night. He seemed to have even better separations than he'd shown the year before. He was massive. As always, his posing screamed, "Class, class, class." No wonder we all thought this would be the night Harold Poole took his deserved place at the very top of the bodybuilding status ladder. But then Bud Parker had come on to say Sergio Oliva was next, and the man's appearance, we knew this was not going to be a night for realizing pipe dreams. For never before had bodybuilding seen anything to equal the musculature of this Cuban refugee. He was bigger than any bodybuilder we'd ever seen. He was cut like a lightweight. And the shape of his muscles, always awe-inspiring, now seemed even more refined than usual. Sergio Oliva was Mr. Olympia before he even got to the posing rostrum. To tell it straight, Oliva had never been your conventional poser. That is to say, he struck poses that were supposedly in the book, only when he hit them, we found ourselves transported into some other realm. His most muscular pose, the way he held his hands together, the way he positioned his legs, was not all that unique. But goodness Lord, no one ever looked like that. He raised his arms into the double biceps pose, and the deltoid seemed to jut out a good foot on either side of the man. Impossible. Most other bodybuilders seemed to narrow down upon striking the double biceps from the front pose, but Oliva is obviously not your regular bodybuilder. He invented his own rule book. Whatever went on before his appearance must now be worked over, adapted, brought into line with Oliva's law. You cannot say with any credibility that Oliva cannot pose. What you might say is that he does not pose like other super bodybuilders. He struck 8 or 9 out-of-this-world poses amidst chaos reminiscent of Scott's Finest Hour, blew his usual kiss to the audience, and slowly strutted off into the wings. Minutes later, Bud Parker came on to announce what we already knew. Sergio Oliva was Mr. Olympia 1967. Sergio would repeat the performance 2 more times. And then he would come up against a miracle called Arnold Schwarzenegger. Ah, but that's another story. No doubt about it, the night they crowned Sergio Oliva Mr. Olympia in 1967 was bodybuilding's greatest moment. For my money, the man was the greatest bodybuilder of all time, which is not the same as saying he was the greatest champion. He has never quite equaled the shape he was that night in 1967, so that Arnold never really beat the man at his best. It's no slur on Arnold's impeccable record to say this. He came, he saw, and what he saw, he conquered. But it would have been interesting had Arnold been there with Poole and the others that night in 1967. Now one wonders, will there ever be another Sergio? All right, guys, and that one came from the July 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. Back then, in 1977 and 78, they were printing some old contest articles from Rick Wayne, and then, like you said, they went all the way back to the 1950 Mr. Universe with Reeves and Park, and then some of those other contests before that, like the 1947 America with Steve Reeves. So some great stuff with some great legends of the sport. All right, guys, well, I hope you enjoyed this trip down memory lane. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Hopefully we can get one of these guys I'm working on to come out here for an interview. Until then, I hope you guys have a great week. Train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.